Aloha and welcome to Town Square. As we always like to tell you, this conversation can include you. If you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu and from the neighbor islands, you can reach us at 877-941-3689. But just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Healthcare advocates cheered last fall's landmark report on addiction by then Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, and soon after, the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act. Some of the reasons included greater access to mental health and substance abuse treatment. Now, a changed political climate may walk that back. Conflicting bills in Congress have rehab advocates concerned. In one bill, there's more funding for opioid treatment, but in the current repeal and replace bill, substance abuse and mental health services are no longer essential benefits unless a state were to legislate their importance and access to care under the ACA Medicaid expansion also hangs in the balance. Against that backdrop, trainers are in Hawaii to work with healthcare providers on the nexus of substance abuse and mental health treatment. Today on Town Square, we're going to take up why that investment in both together could save money and lives. And we want to hear from you. And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is Town Square, and here's our panel. Alan Johnson is the president and CEO of Hina Mauka, which provides drug and alcohol treatment in Hawaii at 24 sites. He's chair of the Hawaii Substance Abuse Coalition. That's a hui of 30 nonprofit treatment and prevention agencies throughout the state. The vision of the HSAC is to advocate for prevention and treatment, educate the community that addiction is a disease, and to reduce the stigma. Kevin McCauley joins me in studio. He is a doctor. He was a naval flight surgeon with the 3rd Marine Air Wing when he became addicted to opioid pain relievers. Following his court-martial and incarceration at Fort Leavenworth and subsequent treatment, he began lecturing on the neuroscience of addiction. He wrote and directed the film Pleasure Unwoven, used by many treatment centers to explain the brain disease of addiction. Currently, he travels between his home in Honolulu and Utah, where he is the director of program services at New Roads Behavioral Health. And by phone, we have Eric Schmidt joining us. He is the adjunct faculty at the University of Utah School of Social Work and is the founder and CEO of New Roads Behavioral Health. New Roads primarily serves clients with severe, persistent mental illness, addiction, and personality disorders. He is also president of the Utah Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you for having us here today.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
When we all saw the 21st Century Cures Act come out, and we had already seen the landmark report from Vivek Murthy, there was a sense that, well, maybe the understanding that the comorbidity of substance abuse and mental health or mental illness is beginning to really move and percolate through the community. And there was a great sense of, you know, optimism about it. How do you describe what you feel right now about that understanding and how you see that moving in the very near future? And Alan, I'm going to start with you because we last talked about this.
Well, today it's really hope on hold. I mean, we had all this hope going, and there was all this transformation going, and all these studies said, hey, we're going to save all this money by changing our processes, changing our structures. We have the technology, but the processes needed to change. And then all of a sudden, nothing. You know, even the and a lot of the healthcare reform wasn't just at a national level. It was happening local here where we were ending our own fragmentation. All that has just stopped and ceases. We're waiting to see what happens. Are we going to continue with ethical care? Or are we not going to? And so we're just at a pause. So we still have hope, but it's on hold.
You make the point about ethical care. Kevin McCauley, how do you describe that in terms of the comorbidity?
Well, I think, at least for addiction is the kind of disease that will exploit whatever weaknesses a particular society or area has. And so if there isn't a high understanding of the needs of people with comorbid mental illness and substance use disorder, or if there's resistance to, for instance, the easy availability of sober housing or housing for such people, or if there's the belief that that healthcare shouldn't be a universal access or even a right, that's going to create problems. In Utah, I felt that the one thing that I could do was fight for the easy availability of safe, sober housing. And for a while, we did a good job with that. But then we started to backtrack a little bit. So that's what I'm concerned about, is that whatever a particular area's prejudices are, the mental illness and the addiction will use that. It will exploit it. And that will be what that group has problems with.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about how that is reflected in Hawaii in just a moment. I want to get to Eric Schmidt. Would you agree with what Kevin just said?
I would, and I think that I would just add the caveat regarding access to housing. In some ways, we have been our own worst enemies. We haven't always been good neighbors, and there has been a sense that the people who are opening some of these homes are not super interested in providing good care, but are actually interested in the real estate itself. And I think that one of the things that we've done here in Utah with Kevin's help is attempted to educate those people that were providing recovery residence services with the concepts and the skills to provide good, adequate care in those settings.
Utah seems to be at the forefront of this in many ways, and we've talked about how housing first was developed in New York, but really took root in Utah in many ways. And also now it seems the understanding about comorbidity of substance abuse and mental illness. Kevin, as you travel back and forth between Honolulu and Utah, what have been some of the issues that you've seen so well handled in Utah that you think Honolulu needs to take notice of, and particularly Hawaii needs to take notice of?
Well, I think every area can learn from what other areas have had success with. Utah, right now we're having this terrible, awful, unprecedented epidemic of opioid addiction and deaths, especially among young people. And Utah was experiencing this 10 years before the rest of the country for some very interesting regional cultural reasons.
What were those?
In Utah, there will be less use of drugs and alcohol among young people. If you look at the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is the standard instrument we use to assess high-risk behaviors in young people, for many years, Utah had the dead last lowest rate of youth smoking, youth drinking, and youth cannabis use. But for several years, it had the highest rate of youth opioid use, which is really, you know, not expected. And that's because Utah had very good cultural resilience against the use of those other drugs because of the high population of LDS people. But there was no resilience against prescription opioids. And so the problem just kind of went there. And so this just exploded. Utah was experiencing these deaths long before the rest of the country. And it's really one of the better stories in public health of how the state mobilized to try to figure out how to combat this, what they came up with. And now I think the rest of the country is learning from Utah. And so that's wherever I go in this country, every community, every county, every state has something that they've discovered that works. And I think if we can share that back and forth, then I think, you know, we'll be able to get a handle on this sooner than later.
Eric Schmidt, listening to what Dr. McCauley is talking about makes me think that, you know, in Utah, there was the idea that, well, okay, if it's prescription drug, it may be raiding mom or dad's medicine cabinet, that was how that was happening. And the real understanding that this is happening in so many families, and maybe families of people who were in government. Is that so?
I think that you're right on, and Kevin is right on. I agree anecdotally, just from the clinical services that I provide and my team provides, we hear two stories over and over, one around opioids, and it is very common, unlike other areas of the country, for someone to be addicted to heroin and have not had much to drink, have not really experimented with marijuana. And I think that what Kevin hit on is exactly correct from what we're hearing from clients' experiences, is the messaging is loud and clear about staying away from alcohol, staying away from those things that are clearly drugs. But we have a very high prescription rate of all kinds of medications here, and there doesn't seem to be quite the stigma around taking a pill, and that's where so many people's opioid addiction begins here in Utah.
And clearly throughout the country and in Hawaii, mm-hmm. too. Alan Johnson, as you listen to this and hear this coming out of Utah, and many people would say, you know, here's a state that is almost diametrically opposed to the way Hawaii operates, you know, politically. What do you take from this in terms of how we see opioid addiction in Hawaii and other forms of addiction?
Well, I think we're seeing a rise in opioid addiction and even heroin addiction here. And I believe underlying that, what we're seeing, especially among our young people and our young adults, is they're saying, I'm having a lot of unresolved issues. There's some pain issues that maybe we tolerated ago decades ago, but now they're saying, I don't have to tolerate. I can take something for that. But we're also seeing a little bit of depression issues, PTSD issues. We're seeing children just not resolving kind of little hurts and pains inside, and they think these kind of pain medications are helping them deal with that. So if they don't know how to process their emotions, they're turning to some of these drugs, and it's more accepted. So I think what we're seeing is the epidemic is coming here because young people are saying, I'm not going to live with my uncomfortable feelings. I can take something for it. And they're gravitating to that. And unless we can get that word out and help people and make a changes in that cultural way of how we respond to issues is I can take a pill for it, we're going to have more problems.
If you're just joining us for Town Square, we're taking a look at the nexus of substance abuse and mental illness and talking to our panel today about why that may or may not be in the treatment future. And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. And maybe some of what you're hearing describes you. We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. It sounds, Alan Johnson, as if you're saying that, you know, parenting took a real turn back there and that somehow we didn't do a good enough job of being able to help young kids and youth cope with life. Was there some sort of social correlation that you see with that? Because
I think what we've become
different than it did years ago.
I don't know that we're not parenting as well. I would think we're parenting better, but expectations are higher. And so before we would say, hey, look, just live with it. And today we're not saying that. We're saying, no, we're going to deal with it. And a lot of the kids would say, well, the way we're dealing with it and the talks I'm having is not enough. And my friends are taking this pill and they're feeling a lot better. Because there is helping them with their unresolved issues to deal with it. And so they're looking for more solutions today and less tolerant for, you know, having some of these feelings or some of these, you know, conflicting emotions that they have. And so they're looking for that solution often turns to medication, especially to a pill form. And you do feel better for a while, and then you're going to feel worse.
Dr. McCauley, as we have seen in the last 15, 20 years, you know, the direct marketing to consumers, picking up magazines that say, you know, talk to your doctor about, and then you read the small print of all the warnings and potential side effects. But some of that very much targeted to kids with all kinds of things, ADHD and other things among them, that began to normalize the idea that consumers could approach their doctor as opposed to maybe the other way around. Good or bad scenario?
Well, I think that law, when it changed, because it used to be that you could only see advertisements in medical journals, that kind of put the idea in people's heads that there was always something that could fix whatever I was feeling right now. That makes sense. There is a very powerful, certainly intuitively a powerful idea called the self-medication hypothesis, that the reason that people drink alcohol is perhaps because they have anxiety or they're depressed. The reason that people use methamphetamine is perhaps they have ADHD or anger issues. This was originally a psychoanalytic theory. Patients love this theory. I don't know how many people say to me, well, when I smoke meth, I calm down. Or when I smoke pot, you know, I can function better in school. There is some evidence for this, but there are increasingly addiction psychiatrists speaking out against it. That actually there is not necessarily a connection between a person's mental illness symptoms and their rate of drug use. In fact, Very often people use drugs when their bipolar disorder, their depression sort of simmer down, right? There's a doctor at Stanford, Dr. Anna Lemke, who's written an entire book. She's very concerned about the fact that if we simply say, well, you know, if we treat your depression or your anxiety or your ADHD, then the addiction will go away. And she's making the point that for a lot of people, you don't have to have those things necessarily. Addiction can purely be a disorder of the brain's hedonic system. And if we just look at that alone, very often we find a lot of explanations.
We also talked to Dr. Lemke when her book came out, mm-hmm. and she also seemed to be making the point of, you know, doctors bear a lot of responsibility in this, and that can't be simply shelved.
It's true, and that's why I think people who study public health will be studying this epidemic for many, many decades in the future. This has never happened before, where the source, the real vector of the public health threat was the prescription pad of doctors. I remember when I was in medical school, we were all taught, you have to get better at pain. You're not, you know, if you're leaving patients in pain, you're not doing your job. And then this was then accelerated when JCO, the Joint Commission it's called today, but back then, they made it a quality of care issue. And so if you weren't asking at any clinic or hospital visit, and they said that the most reliable indicator of whether a patient is in pain or not is to ask them, then you weren't doing your job. And so what happened was is a vast swath of Americans were exposed to medications at a time when increasingly potent formulations were coming out. These were all medications that we'd heard about before, you know, drugs like oxycodone, fentanyl. But now this happened right at the same time as these changes in what was available.
I want to get to your story in just a second, but to remind you that this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Going to Renee, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Renee. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. You just sort of brought up the point that I had about I find it strange to put the onus on the addict or the person who's depressed or sick or whatever it is, because they're not in, you know, a let's put it this sort of powerful state of mind. They're weak. And it's, you know, I think as someone who, I never dealt with depression to the point where I needed to take medication, but I was diagnosed with ADHD, and, you know, I wanted to do well in school, and so I trusted the psychiatrist who prescribed me medication. My mother trusted the psychiatrist who prescribed me medication. And I think it's, you know, I stopped taking it because I started to notice that I really liked taking it more than it was helping me in any way. And I think it's very dangerous to say, well, you know, these addicts should know better. We should really be looking at mental health as sort of almost a national security risk or a local security risk, because if you look at what happened in New York City today, that man had two DUIs. DUIs are supposed to be a way of seeing, well, this person has a problem with alcohol. They clearly do not know how to drink properly, which is a sign of mental health problems.
Renee, forgive me, but I want to stop you because you've made a couple of really good points. First of all, that, you know, why was the onus put on the addict or the patient in your case, with your mother sitting there and the psychiatrist there and, you know, doc saying this is what you need to do, but also the point about networking information. We've had electronic records now for a little while, but the truth is perhaps they aren't working as well as have been intended. And are doctors checking it? Is there really a movement to have doctors look into a central database or as much of one as exists to see if someone has an issue? Thanks very much for the call. I want to go back to you, Dr. McCauley, for a second here, because you have intimate experience with this that the rest of us sitting at this table don't. As you listen to Renee's comments about a doctor saying, here's what you need for your pain, however you want to term pain, that was how you got in trouble.
It was, and what Renee said really touched my heart. I definitely think I need to take responsibility for my recovery. But even as a physician, I had a sort of a belief that opioids could not really produce addiction if they were used for treating pain. And so I'm the first example that I know of this wave of people that we saw who were exposed to opioids in the context of having a surgery and turned out to have a very different subjective experience of opioids. We know that a small percentage of people will have a very powerful hyperphoric response to opioids, which most people don't get, and those people are very likely to go on to opioid addiction. And so with that single prescription, and it was really no one's fault, it was just sort of routine, I was in trouble in a very short period of time.
We're going to talk more about that and also what may be the responsibility or changing responsibilities of docs and other healthcare providers as we go on. I want to get to one of our callers, but just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Going to Shari, calling us from Kailua. Shari, I understand you're the partner of someone who is addicted to pain medication.
That's right.
Go ahead.
I wanted to know if there's any resources for me. I'm basically with a zombie.
Okay. I'm watching a head or two nod around the table. When you say resources in terms of support resources for you, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Shari. Let me ask that of Alan Johnson.
We do have a family program Thursday nights in Kaneohe at Hina Mauka, and you can call our main number. It's 7 to 9 o'clock, and a lot of families come, and it's led by a counselor, and the families share stories and support each other. So there's a lot there, and you learn about what to do, what not to do, and then how to deal with your own, you know, having to your own issues of having to deal with this, you know, of how do I resolve my feelings, too. So
how about Al-Anon?
And Al-Anon is a great place, and there's meetings all over town, and you can call the main office for Alcoholics Anonymous, and you would get Al-Anon, too, there's tons of people out there who support each other. It's self-support.
But the bottom line of it is that when you're in a situation like that, you do need to have your own support because, as we all know, it's not just affecting the person who is addicted to whatever they may be addicted to. It's affecting those people
sphere. And if you have insurance, you can also go see a psychologist or psychiatrist who can help you with that and provide some family counseling. Our marriage and family therapists are out there too that can provide you with support and helping to deal with that. But it really is, if you love somebody and they're suffering, you're impacted. And that's so true. And so often we're really so focused on the person who has these issues without realizing the whole circle of their family and all those that they love are also impacted.
If you're just joining us on Town Square today, we're talking about the nexus of substance abuse and mental illness and why, despite a lot of the optimism of last fall with the 21st Century Cures Act and the landmark report that we saw from then Surgeon General Murty, that this may be changing or perhaps not, depending upon what happens with healthcare and what happens at the local level. Here we are in Hawaii, very far from Washington. What will this mean for us? How are healthcare providers and outreach workers and rehab advocates changing perhaps how they are approaching that comorbidity? Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you'd like to join the conversation. As you're now trying to make more of a case for those who intimately deal with people who are addicted to understand that it's not just the addiction perhaps, but there's also perhaps a cover for mental illness, what does some of that training begin to look like that's different? First, in getting the point across that those things exist together in great part. We've seen this in homeless populations, but to be able to say that this is a middle-class issue, this is an upper-class issue, this is an issue that just goes across all classes and socioeconomic backgrounds, how well are those who are the first line of contact understanding this? Dr. McCauley?
Well, I think, you know, your average primary care provider doesn't have a lot of tools in their bag of tricks. And so you can ask them to ask about addiction, but then you have to make sure that they have connection to the resources that can help. So I have a little sympathy for the physician who asks about it, but then if the answer is yes, what do you do? Interestingly, if you look at the people who actually die from opioid overdoses, see, this is, again, where Utah can be very helpful. They looked at people for whom they could determine that the reason for death was a prescription opioid. And they went back and tried to interview the families of those decedents. And what they found is that in most cases, three things were associated with those deaths. One was the people were having financial problems. They'd been fired or their house was, you know, going to be taken away from
them. So they're under stress.
Right, exactly. They also had many of them had received previous treatment. So they were already identified as having a substance use disorder, right? And yet they still were prescribed a powerful opioid that led to their death. And the third one is they had a comorbid mental illness that wasn't being addressed, but everybody already knew about it. So you think about the families that were trying, that were going through this at the time. And I really feel that families are truly traumatized. They almost have a kind of civilian PTSD because they have to watch all of this happening. And if the person is, you know, high or dead, well, that's, you know, they're not really going through that trauma. But families need a lot more support than they're getting.
Alan Johnson.
Yeah. We really have the best technology in the world here in the United States, and we're really, really good, and all this evidence is really available. But it's really not always out there at the provider level. I mean, we are so fragmented in how we do things and how separate. We haven't really had a holistic, because people come into treatment today, they're diabetic, they got depression, they got PTSD, they got a substance abuse problem, they got hypertension. They got some pretty serious issues out there. Not all, but a lot of them do that are, you know, getting to the chronic conditions. And we just say, well, we'll treat you for your substance abuse, and I hope someday someone helps you with your depression. And so that's really how we've been operating, even though we have this wonderful technology of how we could do that in integrated form, and that's part of the training here is to do more integrated. But also our processes have to change, you know, how payments are made, how reform is, how does government insurance support that integration where we work across and instead of trying to be so separate and segregated. So there's a lot of change that needs to happen, and we have the technology to do that. You know, now we have to develop the will to keep it going, even if we don't have federal support to do that. So, yeah, nobody today just has one thing if you're at a chronic level. It's a multiple chronic condition.
Eric Schmidt, you just heard what Alan Johnson had to say about how systems themselves need to change. How do you see that changing, and what part do you think that you're playing in that?
Well, I do believe that there are providers who have really heard that message. And I think about my own career, and I have worked in a government segmented program that only focused on substance use disorder. And it was really common and frustrating for me to have people come in, and it became clear to us that they had a psychotic disorder, for instance. And we would say, hey, you need to go over to the local mental health agency. They'd go over to the local mental health agency. The local mental health agency would say, I'm sorry, we can't serve you because you need to get your substance use disorder treatment. So this person would basically bounce around, increasing that level of hopelessness that Kevin talked about earlier. And I think one of the things that we've challenged ourselves to do here at New Roads, and also as a provider organization in Utah, is to increase the level of training. So we will recognize that substance use disorder in itself is an issue, like Kevin discussed earlier, but we also know that that person was attracted to that because they maybe had borderline personality disorder. If you are in the level of despair that somebody with BPD has, and you introduce substances, those substances are going to increase the perception that you're okay, at least for a while, and that person's going to continue to seek that perception. And so we know that as treatment providers, we have to get better at being able to, as NIDA says, provide a variety of services in a single setting. And I think I certainly have accepted that challenge, and I know many other people in the country have as well.
Eric, thank you. We had a comment from Marion calling us from Maui. She said her child recently was given a prescription for 20 to 30 pain pills. She didn't say what kind they are. After having teeth pulled, child feels obligated to take them, and the mom is worried about addiction. And Marion is blaming the doctor. I mean, here's a case where, again, the issue of pain and the doctor wanting to make sure that a patient isn't in pain. But, Kevin McCauley, should this mom be worried?
Well, even though we're concerned about the wholesale exposure of the population to powerful opioids, we don't want to limit the ability of people who genuinely need them to get them. So I think it's appropriate, especially after a serious dental surgery, to give good pain relief. But it would be nice if more and more providers, writers of those prescriptions, would follow the CDC prescribing guideline to really sit down with the patients and say, listen, you know, these are the risks of this medication. You know, have you ever had this problem before? You know, does this exist in your family? If they could check the state prescription drug monitoring program to make sure that this person isn't getting other prescriptions. This was something that the CDC was really trying to do, was empower those clinicians to be able to prescribe those medications to people who need them and not to high-risk patients. I don't know if this young person, you know, needs those medications or whether it's a risk that shouldn't have been taken.
How often, though, does that happen, from your experience, where docs actually go and follow that procedure? I mean, we hear about docs now, or at least nurses asking a patient when they come into an office, you know, what's your rate of pain today? Have you been depressed in the last couple of weeks? I mean, those questions that are starting to happen more routinely. But in terms of following the CDC procedure to begin to tease out a little bit whether or not there's a problem, how often does that happen?
I think it will become more common. It's not nearly as common as it should be. The CDC really doesn't have the power to enforce its guideline. State medical boards do. And so that means you have this patchwork of compliance to these things. Some states are very good. Some states don't even have a PG. Well, one state in particular doesn't even have a prescription drug monitoring program. So I think increasingly the standard is being set for prescribers to ask these questions and to be confident in their answers and to be more careful about certainly about prescribing chronic opioid therapy for chronic pain, non-cancer pain.
Well, we're really shifting awareness, and a lot of doctors are coming along, and we're setting up new systems to make that change, because before it was, you know, you look like you're an okay family. Look, here's a lot of pain medications. And then all of a sudden there's addiction. Go, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I thought you were, you know, from a good family. But you can get addiction. And we supported some bills this time that said we're going to have informed consent, so the doctor has to go through a checklist explaining things. And we're really supporting of the prescription monitoring drug program, where you enter that in so that if you find you're having troubles and you go back two or three times for drugs, it's being reported. So you can start, so the doctor can say, oh, I think that's too many. Because before the doctor said, oh, I'll have more. And now there's a growing awareness where the doctors say, maybe that's too much.
One thing we haven't really talked about fully yet, and I want to get to this and also some more of our callers, is here we are in Hawaii where we have a medical marijuana law. We have great difficulty in being able to get the dispensaries up and running. So people are told that if they're in pain and their doctor says this is a good idea and they've got a medical marijuana card, they can have it if they can find it, if they have a caregiver who can grow it for them. But how do you see that fitting into the issue of addiction and abuse when some people are saying, well, hey, at least we have a lot of at least anecdotal understanding of what medical marijuana can do versus some of these other medications that someone may be given for mental illnesses, depression, anxiety, especially PTSD. And, you know, people are wondering, are we looking at medical marijuana truly in a very different way? Dr. McCauley, how do you view that?
Well, this is a tough subject. In fact, it's one of the things that we're going to be talking about at the conference. All of these intoxicants have some effect on mental illness, okay? So opioids are powerful antidepressants. And what would be nice is to be able to tease out what part of that opioid drug is actually producing that effect. There's increasing evidence that it's not really happening at the receptor for opioids in our brains that deal with pain or euphoria. It's happening at another receptor that is all about dysphoria. And if we could block that, then we would see some decrease in that. Same thing with cannabinoids. They're powerful pain relievers. They do work on certain things. The problem is that it would be nice to be able to divorce that medicinal effect which I really truly do believe is there, and we'll find out exactly how it's there, from its intoxication potential, right? So when you're talking about medical marijuana, if I had a cannabinoid, a cannabis that you could smoke that was great for glaucoma and could really improve wasting syndrome for HIV or AIDS, and it did all these wonderful things, but it took out the intoxication, I think you would find that people were not as celebratory of all of this as they'd like to be. For a lot of people who wave that card around, they just want to get high. And I think that when, you know, more and more recreational laws are passed in varying states, we're really going to see the problem with this intoxicant, not in your average user. Most people are going to use the smoke pot and they'll be okay. What I'm worried about is how is this threat going to fall upon communities of disenfranchisement, of color, of poverty, of people who are already disconnected from mental health and medical services? Those are the people who are really going to pay for these legalization efforts.
We're going to talk more about that, but I promise we're also going to get some more of our callers in. I want to go now to Anne, calling us from Honolulu. Anne is a pharmacist. Hi, Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
A pleasure.
I'm a Honolulu retail pharmacist, and we deal with many opioid prescriptions on a daily basis. And we have to somehow vet these prescriptions. We have to decide whether they're legitimate or non-legitimate. And by that I mean, is it actually for pain or for something else? Well, you can't really do that. So it's a difficult situation for pharmacists. We look at the prescription monitoring program that we have for every prescription. But basically, all you're looking for there is the last time somebody picked up an opioid or a controlled substance. It doesn't really tell you if the person is undergoing pain management or they're addicted or not or something like that. We have no way of knowing that. It'd be nice to have doctors be associated with pain clinics, we would know if an opioid prescription was for chronic pain, not for acute pain, but for chronic pain, if an opioid was, quote, legitimate, or prescription was legitimate or not. It's a difficult situation for local pharmacists.
Okay, let me see if I can get some answers for you around our table, because I'm watching heads nod. Thanks very much, Anne, for the call and for your patience in waiting to get on.
Well, you know, I'm also a member of the task force, the Narcotic Policy Task Force, and that's comprised of pharmacies and hospitals and doctors and University of Hawaii and legislature and judge all, and providers like myself. And so we are reaching out. We've seen there's a lot of laws coming around that are not all comprehensive yet and trying to address all the systemic changes we need to make. And some things are being implemented ahead of others. But you can say, I can say it is being, can be cumbersome and administratively, as some laws have passed and others haven't. But there is a plan to have a much more comprehensive, more efficient way of doing this that can help change and address that problem, and not just say it's, you know, the pharmacists have to do that. So more things are coming in the next few years as a lot of people have come together to try to help make that a better.
We're going to go now to Keith, calling us from Pahoa. Keith, I understand you're a recovering addict, now sober.
Yeah. So I was just kind of listening, and I heard a lot of good things, and I heard some things that kind of troubled me. I've been sober for multiple years. I actually got my start using through prescription painkillers. I got a few injuries playing sports as a kid and ended up with some prescriptions. And you know, I got going on it and started using other drugs. And things got progressively worse and worse and worse. And I'd end up in institutions and things like that for mental health treatment, and with the criminality issue that we're facing with substance abuse as a whole, I personally found it hard to really be honest with these mental health professionals that I was using these substances. So it was difficult for them to make an accurate diagnosis at the time. They said I had borderline personality and schizoaffect, but I was high on a lot of drugs, and you know, today I don't have those diagnoses. I'm blessed to say that I've been sober for a while, and it's just kind of there's a lot of disheartening stuff going on with it, because I don't feel like we're criminals. I feel like we more have the mental illness of addiction, especially mind and allergy of the body.
Mm-hmm. Keith, can I ask you, I just want to make sure we understand this correctly. So now you have none of the diagnoses that you had before, the mental health illnesses that you had before, none of those exist for you now?
Correct.
All right.
I wasn't honest with any of the doctors. I'd be off on multiple different drugs and drug combinations, and it appeared as if I had these certain diagnoses, but I wouldn't be honest. And
so
now
it's almost the inverse of what happens when sometimes people are using drugs to mask some of those illnesses. Hey, thanks very much for calling. We appreciate your candor and also your patience in waiting to tell us your story. Thank you, Keith. I want you to both to comment on that, because that seems to be a little bit different than what we've heard from others who say, I knew that there was a problem and I'm trying to self-medicate, something what you were talking about a little earlier, Keith. Kevin, I'm sorry, I'm looking at Keith's name here. How do you begin to tease, that apart when now, as a sober person, he has none of those diagnoses, supposedly, from what he's telling us, that he had before in the way he was presenting when he was high on combinations of drugs?
It's very hard. In fact, I would say it's almost impossible to tease the two out in early sobriety. The effects of drugs can look like depression, can look like schizophrenia, can look like all these other things. Even being in early sobriety can look like a personality disorder. And if you can just get the person some sober time, especially if you can get them support from other recovering peers, and like I said, safe housing, a lot of that starts to clear. Sometimes it won't, and we would certainly want to be able to take care of that person too. I think that I would have met a lot of diagnoses in my first 6 months of sobriety, which I certainly don't have now. I have to say I was moved by your caller's words. I remember what it's like to walk into a probation officer's, office and be just really terrorized by my own fear of relapsing. And I use that word, deliberately. It really was a time of terror, because I think people in early recovery are put into all kinds of impossible situations. I can remember the DA in Orange County, where I got sober, saying, you're going to go back to prison. That's what drug addicts do. They relapse, and the minute you do, I'm going to send you back to prison. I don't know if you would still think that way today. That was a long time ago.
Well, 20 years ago, exactly.
Yeah, exactly right. But, I mean, that's a really hard thing. How do you stay sober when, if you don't stay sober, something terrible is going to happen to you, when the very areas of the brain that you need to do that are impaired? And that, I think, is an unfair situation. So it's hard to be honest. It really takes a lot of work on both parts to be able to create that safe space where a person can say, I realize you're thinking that I have this, but I got to be honest. I got high in the bathroom on the way in here, and be able to work from there.
Eric, I want to ask you if you have a comment about that, too, for the caller that we just heard.
Oh, I like Kevin, just really, really feel for him. We typically, because we do serve clients with more severe persistent mental illness, we often inherit these clients, and I don't know how Keith necessarily got those diagnoses, but we do inherit these clients with sometimes a long list of diagnoses where they've been in very short-term care, and they weren't able to form the kind of rapport they need. And the ones we see quite frequently are some of the ones that he referred to, antisocial personality disorder, because in order to maintain their addiction, people often engage in criminal activity, and so they garner an inappropriate diagnosis. The other one we see is bipolar disorder, because some of the drugs really mimic manic episodes, and they actually don't have that, and they also are not hyperactive. The other one is narcissistic personality disorder. So, again, in early recovery, people tend to use narcissistic defenses, which is 100% normal in those early stages of recovery, because they have to defend them. They're fragile at that point, and so they're using a defense mechanism. And those of us who understand that that's what's happening don't rush to dismantle those. They dismantle on their own, usually. And I think he's right. It's unfortunate, because the other piece of that is that now they have these diagnoses, multiple diagnoses, and they're on multiple meds to address diagnoses that they don't actually have. And so I think he's right that does happen, and we see that all the time. And it just takes then on our part time to hang in there with the patient or client to and actually removing drugs to see what symptoms are there.
I want to ask you before we move on to our next caller. You know, we've heard this term early recovery several times now. How do you quantify early recovery? Are we talking 6 months? Are we talking a year? Are we talking 2 years? What in your mind is early recovery?
Well, and I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. When I'm talking about early recovery, I'm talking really about those first 90 days when we're really having to take an observation stance. We're observing symptoms and ascertaining whether is this a mental health related symptom or is this a symptom of somebody who's in who's detoxing or is dealing with the shame, guilt, or trauma that's related to their drug and alcohol use. So for me, I'm really talking about 90 days or so. Different people have different definitions for what that is.
Alan, yeah. Jonathan, come into this one.
Yeah, this is why we need a process change. There's, you know Kevin and Eric are having an organization that's dealing with both issues. Hinomoka is doing that too. But we have drug-induced psychosis. So, all right, you have a chemical imbalance. You're coming in. You have all these mental illnesses. And then we find out, 3 months to 6 months later, they're abating. They're going away. And we thought, oh, you never had it all this time. It was this chemical imbalance in your brain, and your brain's healing itself. So there's in a shorter period of time, you could start to see, okay, no, you're getting better. But for other people, it can maybe take a little longer. But we do know the brain from the studies, it's not exactly clear, but it depends on frequency and intensity of use. But your brain could take several years to heal. So, how does that happen in there? And how? And are we still checking what your mental illness is and what's going through that?
And Alan and all of you can chime in. Is this age dependent? So if you have someone who is in the 50s and deciding, okay, it's time for me to get sober and is presenting in a certain way and needing time to be able to process versus someone who may be half that age?
Well, I think it's definitely age sensitive is that, again, it isn't 100% this or that, but we can say if you get your addiction at 50 because you started taking pain, medication, and now you're exhibiting some mental illness, probably drug-induced. Not for sure, but probably you were, unless you were not diagnosed before, but unless it was severe. I mean, if it's severe, it would have shown up. So we're probably saying it's probably drug-induced. If you're young, we're really not sure because, these mental illnesses manifest from early age till about 25 to 26, so you're not sure.
Well, when we were told yesterday by Paul Gianfrido, the head of Mental Health America, who was on the show with us on the conversation yesterday, that from age 11 on, you begin to see this, or you can begin to see that, but especially between 14 and 25, where it really shows up.
You do see that, and especially if it's going to be a more chronic condition, if it's not as extremely severe, you may not see it until they're in their early 20s. And so it's not a for sure answer, but as soon as they are not doing well and they're manifesting symptoms, then we need to take address of that. And if you're using substance abuse too, then you have to do it. And that's like places like Eric's and Hinomoka now, we have a psychiatrist someplace. But we're the exception because we're leaders in our field trying to change things, but the majority of treatment agencies are still split apart and not doing it. And that's why we're saying there's a process change because we need to treat the person where they're at, and we don't have process to do that.
And I promise we're going to get to our callers in a second. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you want to join us. But just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. I got to ask you about when you're talking about kids, though, and the process that looks at kids who are particularly vulnerable in that time period between, say, 11 and 25. And if a kid starts using drugs at 12, 13, 14, 15, how, again, more difficult does that become to disentangle a mental illness from what may be induced by the drug use?
Well, it gets complicated because for early kids who use, as we know in some drugs, for on a developing brain, you may develop a mental illness that you would not have had you not used drugs. So all of a sudden, it may not go away. You would not have had it if you had never used drugs. But now that you've used a lot of drugs, now you do have something, and it just doesn't go away. Even if you stop, it could go on for years and years after that. And for other folks, they don't have a mental illness, but now they have a chemical imbalance, and they show exhibits of it, and then it does go away. And for some people, it goes away fairly fast, but other people may take a number of years, though you should see something happening in the first several months.
All right. Thanks very much for that. We're going to move on now to Kathy calling us from Lahaina. Aloha, Kathy, and thank you very much for your patience. You had a question about medicinal cannabis.
Yes. I have a friend who is in Desert Storm. He's a veteran. And I've been investigating a little bit about cannabis. And I found out online that cannabis oils can have the THC extracted from them. So as the gentleman was discussing earlier, being able to split the beneficial qualities from the addictive or what would you call it? Not alcoholic, but...
Well, I think you said the addictive properties, yeah.
Right. And I was wondering if he's heard about that or if he's had any experience with that.
Okay, so...
I've heard about...
I'll have Dr. McCauley answering you.
Yeah, sure. So when you light a marijuana cigarette, right, when you burn marijuana, cannabis, thousands of drugs are produced. Many of them are intoxicants. Some are not. There have to be some medications in there that could really help people. And I think eventually we will be able to extract those medications and find out their usefulness. So if we can separate cannabidiol, which is one of those chemicals, from THC, which is an intoxicant, we might find that that chemical is very helpful for a particular kind of seizure disorder in children called Dravet syndrome. Even in Utah, CBD oil is allowed in this very conservative, very red state. They passed a law to be able to do that. I think where you get into trouble is when you have the effect of the drug that's beneficial mixed in with intoxication. Again, intoxication for the vast majority of people is not going to be a problem. But for some people, it's going to be they're much, much more vulnerable to the effects of that intoxicant. And certainly with young people, they are. I don't think anyone's arguing at all that this drug is good in a developing brain. And that research is pouring in that there's true harm that's caused when a developing brain is exposed to powerful intoxicants. And we're not
including marijuana.
Yeah, and we're not talking about the joint that, you know, you and I might have passed around in high school 25 years ago. We're talking about extremely potent forms of cannabis, really, you know, crystallized THC that's being smoked in a glass pipe with a butane torch. I mean, that is almost a different drug than, you know, a marijuana cigarette.
I'm glad you said that because part of our coalition's prevention agencies, and they would be aghast if I didn't say that for young developing brains, including especially marijuana, because in Hawaii it's marijuana is the biggest use. If you abuse it, you know, I'm not talking about occasional use, but if you abuse marijuana, you do lose IQ points. So, growing body of evidence is saying you don't get it back; it never returns. If you're an adult, you're going to lose some brain functions. But if you start using marijuana and brain, you'll lose some. But your brain is fairly resilient, and you're going to get most of it back. But if you're a kid, you're not. You lose it permanently
because you short-circuited the growth.
You short-circuited the growth. So it's really careful to say, okay, it's a milder drug. Okay, that's you're using it as an adult. But as a kid, oh boy, don't.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's important to just put right out on the table is that one of the biggest correlations between youth smoking is the degree to which the parents smoke. Those are not divorceable. And so that really, you know, that really just needs to kind of be put out there, even if it's controversial.
Well, if your kids are having seizures, and I see that at the legislature where their parents
talk.
And that and you maybe that's okay, you're going to live with what the impact is because the seizures are too devastating not to. I understand.
Well, that's sort of doing that cost-benefit analysis. Yeah. But in all of this, when you talk about use of marijuana, we haven't even talked about edibles. She brings up oil, but the edibles that we're seeing that are being commercially advertised, you know, for anxiety or in this list, this growing list of maladies that, you know, eating this, you know, edible little gummy bear type thing that's got, the cannabinol, that seems to be now a new market for that too, which means that consumers have to be increasingly aware of what it may do or what it might not do. But are we concerned about how much those are beginning to proliferate as well? And also the fact that we don't have a whole lot of marijuana research because we haven't been able to do a whole lot of marijuana research. So this is like kind of shooting in the dark.
But I will say then there is research being done. And if you were to go to the search engine for the National Institutes of Health, PubMed.org, and plug it in, you will see article after article after. So the research is there. It's just that we're still trying to fight against the drug war and the absolute outrageous misinformation that was propagated. And so a lot of this is the blowback from that. So, well, so I think if you have candy that looks, you know, that has marijuana in it, children are going to use it. And I can tell you right now, at New Roads, we have a tremendous number of people, young people, with psychosis. How did they get there? Cannabis. And so for the people that it doesn't affect, great. But Eric and I are struggling with a huge number of people who we would not have otherwise seen had they not been exposed to this.
All right, I want to get another caller in. Jim calling us from the Big Island. Jim says he's a recovering addict, but you've had some problems with medical doctors over the years, have you?
Yes. Maybe 15 or plus years ago, I had chronic back problems. And doctor put me on Vicodin 10. I think I was getting like 8 a day for like 6 years. And I also got, in that period, I became more of a drug person than I thought I was. I also became addicted to benzodiazepines. But the last 2 years of that 6 years, I was seeing a psychologist because I was going through so much depression and suicidal kind of things and stuff. And I was very honest with him, and I was even honest with my MD. And, for 2 years, I think I was in an AA meeting, and I was kind of complaining about how these doctors are no damn good and I'm going to die and all this stuff. And a doctor came over and gave me his card, and he's an addiction doctor. And so for almost 7 years now, I've been on Suboxone. Hello?
Yeah, yes, we're listening to you. Go ahead.
And, at the time, I was, like, so just, like, kind of angry. Like, wow, I've been talking to these professionals all these years, and this help was there. It was waiting for me. Because, you know, I had to go to treatment and, you know, I had to go through some horrible withdrawals, especially the benzos. I had a seizure and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I got through it. And, I just wonder, for opiate addicts that have chronic pain like myself, this is available to them.
Well,
Jim, it is a complication. You are dependent on it. I can't live without it or I'll get sick.
All right, Jim, forgive me, but we're coming to the top of the hour, and I want to be able to close up this conversation a little bit. And again, we'll open this up, I'm sure, another time, because obviously, as we know, this is not going away. But we have just a couple minutes left. I want to go right around the table and include you, Eric, in our virtual table. And as you look at where we are now and where you see we need to go, how hopeful are you, and what instruction might you give to Hawaii, given Hawaii's slight difference in the way we have been able to approach this and the fact that we are so very small?
Oh, well, I think I have a measured degree of hope for states like Hawaii and even states like Utah. It looks like whatever Congress, if Congress comes up with a repeal and a replace, that a lot of it will be punted to the states. The wonderful thing that I'm learning today is that there's a lot of activity, political activity around this issue in Hawaii, as there is in Utah, and that gives me hope because for years now we've had the ear of a lot of our legislators.
All right, we've just got a minute to go. I'm going to have Kevin McCauley, and then I'll let you finish up.
Okay,
Alan, go ahead.
I'll say real quick, I love Jim's story, quite frankly. To me, that's a good recovery story. It would be nice if it was a little bit more formal, if that person knew that addiction medicine physician, that addiction medicine specialist, and that doctor could help the patient as their sobriety progressed from 1 year to 5 years to 10 years with things that come up, like depression, because that's where both the AA and the doctor can help.
Well, the hope on hold is coming from the federal government. But, here in the state, we can do our own thing. We can take that hope and move it forward and change processes, so it's time for us to do it ourselves.
Well, let's hope you're right. Alan Johnson, Dr. Kevin McCauley, and Eric Schmidt, thank you so much for joining me for Town Square, and thank you to all of you who called and who tuned in. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for The Conversation, right back here at 11 o'clock.